Welcome to the Climate Brides podcast, where we try to untie the knots between climate change and child marriage. My name is Ritika Revathi Subramanian, and I'm your host. Join me as I speak with survivors, frontline workers, activists, journalists, and researchers in and from South Asia to unpack the everyday lives and resistances of young communities braving some of the biggest challenges of the 21st century. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts. The Climate Brides podcast is supported by the University of Cambridge Public Engagement Starter Fund 2021. If you want to learn more about today's topic, head over to our website, where we have full transcripts of the episode, a specially curated reading list, climate models and infographics. Until then, follow the Climate Brides page on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook to stay tuned and stay updated. The world's largest mangrove rainforest, the Sundarbans, sprawls across India and Bangladesh and forms a natural border between the Bengal Delta and the Indian Ocean. With worsening cyclones, sea level rise, and loss of land to erosion and saltwater, the forested islands of the Sundarbans are considered to be one of the most climate vulnerable locations on the planet. These disasters have repeatedly uprooted families and decimated the incomes of residents who have traditionally relied heavily on agriculture and fishing for their livelihoods. Multiple UN agencies, such as the UNICEF and the UN Development Programme, have warned that climate change will increase exploitation of minors, including child marriage and trafficking. This fear is already a reality in the Sundarbans. In today's episode, we are joined by Dr. Upasana Ghosh, a senior social anthropologist working in the field of public health, gender and climate change. She's currently affiliated with the Indian Institute of Public Health in Bhubaneswar in India. Through her work, which is primarily situated in the Sundarbans, Dr. Ghosh studies social vulnerabilities and political economic dynamics of communities confronting climate change at the last mile. Dr. Ghosh has been published in several leading journals, including Lancet Planetary Health, BMJ South Asia, and British Medical Journal. We are very excited to learn more from her insights and experiences.
Hello, thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm really excited to welcome you to the Climate Brides podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me in this exciting thing.
Okay. So to begin with, you know, it'll be great to know a little bit more about the work that you do. And, you know, if you can give us an overview of the kind of work that you've been doing over the years.
Okay. So to begin with my work, I'm an anthropologist working in the juncture of public health, climate change and gender. So my focus areas are how climate change is playing an important role to shaping out people's life, their livelihood, their identity, and the social challenges they are facing. So I get the opportunity to work in such a climatically vulnerable zone, which is called the Sundarbans, which is divided between India and Bangladesh. It is the largest mangrove delta. And I have done my PhD on climate change and social determinants of people's health and their well-being in that particular region. And close to 10 years, I'm researching in Sundarbans. And I mean, in front of my eyes, I have seen the society is changing as the climate change is impacting their livelihood, their life, and in fact, every sphere of their life. So it's very unfortunate to see this, but at the same time, it is fascinating to see people's aspirations, especially the girls and the women, and how they are trying to rebuild the entire system towards a climate change transformation.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And, you know, this brings me to the question around like the particular vulnerabilities of the Sundarbans, you know, where you spend so much time. Could you tell us a bit more on the climate vulnerabilities of the region?
Okay, so the Sundarbans is the largest mangrove delta in the world. It is a World Heritage site. UNESCO heritage sites. And though the ecologically the region is unified, but it has been divided politically between India and Bangladesh. So both the countries have their own political way of handling this region, which is it has a colonial history of people inhabiting there. They have that jungle-based economy. So, but now close to 30, 40 years, mainly the traditional livelihood like the agriculture and fishing are depleting because of sea level rise, because of salinity intrusion in the agricultural field and sweetwater fishing ponds. And as well as there are cyclones almost every year. But at the same time, as you know, the cascading effect of this direct impact or the immediate impact like cyclone or flood, Sundarbans has its long-term impact of climate change, like food security in terms of their shelter and in terms of their societal transitions. Like as the livelihood is depleting there, the male folks, especially the male folks, are migrating outside as wage laborer. And the women are basically the main inhabitant now in the Sundarbans. So the women are taking now facing a kind of, triple burden of work. So first thing, they have to take care of their children. They have to take care of their elderly in-laws. They have to take part in the livelihood restoration processes, which they have lost during the floods and cyclones, as well as they have to do all the household chores. So basically, the women are facing this kind of burden, and which has a kind of, twisted gender negotiation. So so basically, if we see the ecological impacts, definitely it has the impact on the livelihood, which is very crucial, and the cascading impacts on the social life.
Right. And, in that context, could you tell us a bit more on the local populations themselves? Like, could you tell us a bit more on the demography of the populations, like in terms of, the people living there?
Okay. So if we see the demography of Sundarbans, Sundarbans majority part, the 70% of Sundarbans is in Bangladesh, and India got the rest of the 30%. So in this 30% in Sundarbans, we have close to 5 million people. And in Bangladesh part, as it is the most of the reserve forest, the Royal Bengal Tigers are famous from Sundarbans. So most of the reserve forest area are now in Bangladesh. And there also we can find around 2.5 million people. So these peoples basically religiously, they are Hindus and Muslims in both the countries. And the interesting things of their cultural syncretism, they belong to a cultural syncretism that is called the cult of Bone Bibi. So Bone Bibi is the deity of jungle. When you are going to the jungle to collect the forest products like the honey, then paraffin, then any other jungle woods. So the Bone Bibi would, she's the goddess who can protect you from the tiger attack or the crocodile attack. So, but that was kind of a glue that that binded the two religious peoples together since their inhabitation. But very recently, as the climate change impacts are affecting the livelihood and people and the forest rules of both the countries, people are no more able to go to the jungle in that frequency that they were previously. So their jungle dependency is receding, and so as their dependency on or the belief on Bone Bibi. So here, and the mainstream religions like Hinduism and Islam are taking place of that culturally syncretic, cult of Bone Bibi. And in Indian part, most of the so-called scheduled caste and scheduled tribe populations were the marginalized populations in terms of Indian constitutions. they are the maximum, their inhibitions are there. So socioculturally and economically, the Sundarbans peoples, both in India and Bangladesh, they are historically marginalized. And climate change are just pushing them towards more marginalizations.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that the region has been known about, as you also mentioned earlier, has been, you know, these intense and frequent cyclones in particular. You know, one talks about climate change, and in the last 10 years or so, the intensity that we are seeing globally has also increased. Can you speak a bit more on what has the region seen, say, in the last decade? You know, what are some of the big sort of events?
The first big event was Ayla that happened in 2009, both in India and Bangladesh part of Sundarbans, which has a landfall near the Sundarbans. So after that, the it was a turning point, which I'd like to mention here, that since then, especially the Indian part of Sundarbans have started getting the developmental searchlights. For example, soon after Ayla, there were lots of, you know, developmental agencies, aid organizations, and they came for the rehabilitation, for the rescue, and the distributions of goods, resources, everything. If we see, like, in the socioeconomic pattern of Sundarbans, it was a very crucial event, the Ayla in 2009. And after that, the Sundarbans, you know, resource politics has changed quite a lot. So, but the impact of the work on climate change impacts, or the intervention specifically adapting towards climate change, was very less. At the same time, Bangladesh part, as it has faced more cyclones than Indian part, it has developed its disaster risk reduction plan, climate adaptation plan, much you know, before the Indian part. So May 2020 was another big event happened to Indian part of Sundarbans. I can say that event gave a big push towards the policy change in terms of Sundarbans. But before, the government could plan, or even the people got out of the shock of Amphan, Cyclone Yash happened in 2021. So these two big cyclones back to back really broke the backbone, the economic and the policy backbone of Sundarbans.
No, right. And I think since you've spent considerable amount of time on the field as well, what are some of the ways in which, like, the local communities in the Sundarbans understand climate change? You know, is it referred to as climate change, or, you know, in terms of daily experiences and events which sort of make up the imagination of it?
Okay. No, this is a very interesting question. If you talk to any person in a region like Sundarbans, you can imagine that they don't have the scientific knowledge of climate change. But interestingly, some top-down knowledge, and I would not say it is a knowledge, but it is a top-down blame game, is happening, towards the people of Sundarbans. Like, they have done something wrong. They have cut the mangroves, and that's why these cyclones are happening. So, this is a very dominant narrative of climate change which has been imposed to the people of Sundarbans, and they really feel that, you know. So they definitely perceive the weather changes, the sea level rise. They can identify from their childhood knowledge or from their childhood experience that definitely the sea level is rising. And the river is getting shallower. So that's their understanding. They can also figure out that, you know, the rainfall is very unpredicted now. And they can also understand that the heat has been increased. The cyclonic events has been increased. So they have this kind of knowledge from their experience. These are experiential knowledge of the Sundarbans peoples. But at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, a very top-down knowledge that, yes, you guys are the, you guys have done wrong, and that you have to pay for that. So that is something very dominating there. And you can find 2-3 people in every, you know, village, many journalists or even the international journalists have interviewed them, and they were saying, oh my God, this is climate change, and we are responsible for that. Now the God is giving back to us, blah, blah, blah. So I can't say this is a knowledge of climate change. This is a dominant narrative imposed to them by the policymakers, by the scientists, or whoever on the ever. You know, in our research, we categorized the heuristics of above, middle, below of the stakeholders or the actors. So the above are the so-called natural scientists or the policymakers or the administrators. Middles are the basically the NGOs or researchers like us who are trying to breach this different knowledge frames. And the below are the communities. So every set of actors have their own knowledge frame about climate change.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Ghosh, you mentioned something important about, like, you know, communities being busy with just surviving every day in that sense. One of the, aspects that we've seen in a lot of climate hotspots has been about the impacts that, you know, this need for survival has on the lives of young women and girls, you know, which is also the focus of the podcast. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit more on, the community of women and girls in the region and, mm-hmm. you know, their specific vulnerabilities.
So, as I mentioned earlier, that to restore the livelihood or to, you know, just for the subsistence, the male folks of Sundarbans villages are, out migrated. So, though most of the migration is seasonal migration, not the permanent one right now. In Bangladesh part, most of them have migrated permanently, and they end up in Dhaka's slum. But in Indian part of Sundarbans, they have started this migration seasonally, and the women and girls, and along with the elderly, they are the one who are residing in the islands right now. So they have to face the women and girls. They have a typical kind of, you know, we see a cycle of vulnerability. So what is happening? It's like they have to take care of everything. They have to take care of the children. They have to take care of the households. They have to earn. So previously, the women who were not in part of the economic process of the region, now they are in the part. If you see the demographic and the economic demography of the region, you will find that many of the women folks join the unskilled labor force. Because as they were the traditional fisherwoman and the agriculturist, the farmers, so they don't have any other skill of life. I mean, any other alternatives. So they are not good at doing embroidery or some cottage industries. So they are not skilled to that, and there is no scopes for building their skills on that also. So the women are ending up, doing jobs of wage laborer, agricultural laborer. But at the same time, they, due to the patriarchal norms and regulations, they are not able to go out with their husbands or brothers or fathers for a better remittance. They have to stick within this island, and they have to find work there. So their situation is very strenuous. Most of the women are now joining a very risky livelihood options, which is the crab catching. So the crab catching, you have to do, first of all, you have to go to the reserve forest area, mostly illegally, because there are forest rules. You cannot get into the reserve forest area. You have to take lots of permission. So most of them are going to that reserve forest. They have to stand whole day in waist deep water to get the crabs. and they are very prone to the attack of tiger and crocodile. So the situation is quite stressful for them, for their health, for their well-being, and at the same time for their mental health. Most of the households are facing this livelihood stress, which is increasing the phenomena of domestic violence. So child marriage, adolescent marriage is rampant. I mean, you can find 14 years, 13 years, 15 years girls getting married, though the official age is 18. But below 18 marriage is very, very common. Now, another layer is there that it is the region, since from the very beginning, these are the international borders regions, and human trafficking in both the countries are very high from this region. There are some NGOs, who have the data, like every time the floods happen, the number of girls from Sundarbans has increased in Kolkata's brothels. So they are subjected to human trafficking, prostitutions, everything. So it is a very complex situations. And the child lines, the government, all are doing to, intervene in this particular area to stop this child marriage, to stop human trafficking. But still now, nothing is working as expected.
Yeah, you've covered a range of very, very crucial points, and, which I also wanted to unpack a little more. One of the things that you spoke about was in the context of child marriage, I wanted to understand one thing in terms of how is a child, like who's a child, locally? Like, what are the perceptions of who's a child or who's an adult, like in terms of who is considered to be marriageable in that sense? Are there any community perceptions or is it largely survival driven?
See, in like many part of India, a girl, as soon as she get her menstruation, she's marriageable. So these perceptions are still prevalent in rural India. So that is the first thing. The literacy rate in Sundarbans, including the female literacy rate, is higher than the state average. So the typical, stereotypical indicator for development, like the woman empowerment indicator as woman literacy, that indicator is not working in Sundarbans. Though the girls are educated, but this survival twist, you mentioned rightly, the survival twist is basically pushing them to marry off. So maybe if there is no economic stress, maybe that girl could have completed the 18 years, because there are some government schemes also. If you complete your educations till 18 years, you will get some money from the government. So there are some schemes, and which is running well in other parts of West Bengal. But in case of Sundarbans, the major push is now the reducing numbers from the family. And many a times the parents know that this marriage may end up in a kind of trafficking, but they still want to get rid of an extra head from the family. So that is the complex situation.
Right. And, like you point out, there are so many layers involved. One of the things that I wanted to ask you a bit more on was, how are these marriages actually fixed? What are the exchanges involved from your in conversations on the ground? What are some of the marriage practices that are involved? Like, for instance, we were recently talking to somebody who works on the IDP camps in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole practice of bride price that exists. Which is negotiated with drought and, which has an impact. I was wondering, what are some existing practices of bridal practices that exist in the Sundarbans?
Okay, so as a practice, as a cultural practice, we don't practice bride price. We give dowry. So that is a kind of traditional rule, and we still give dowry to our daughters. But this particular point, this particular practice, has a negative impact. Somebody who is saying that I won't take any dowry to get married to your daughter, and at the same time, I will bear all the expenses of marriage. So the parents are very happy and gladly, let the girl marry her. So, you see, if a girl is like growing up, she's educated. So you tend to think that as I'm economically getting poorer, how can I arrange dowry for my daughter? So that is a common perception. Maybe I have built some asset which I would have given to my daughter during the marriage, but that has been washed off in last flood. So I don't have any means to get my daughter married off with a good amount of dowry. So in that case, somebody came to me and say that, see, I'm very liberal. I don't want any dowry. I just want your daughter. And I will also take care of the expenses of the marriage. So it is a brilliant offer. And the marriages are happening. So here again, climate change indirectly playing a major catalyst to this kind of marriages.
These marriages, marriages which are sources of trafficking and other things. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, not all the marriages are, source of trafficking, but many of them are ended up in human trafficking.
Okay.
That's the thing.
Right. On that note, one of the things that I wanted to ask you was that when you spoke about dowry, what have you been hearing from the field, in terms of over the years, say, like you pointed out earlier, like the last 20 years have had a huge impact on the livelihood opportunities and, the economic, social insecurities have increased. How has dowry sort of changed? Has it been negotiated differently, or, what are some of the ways in which these exchanges have been impacted?
So the dowry is like here the twist is like two twister there. So one is you can give in kind, not in cash. In kind, you can give the house or a plot of land or a plot of agricultural land or maybe a motorcycle or motorbike. So that is a very, lucrative thing for a groom. So this kind of thing, and ornaments to the girl. So we are now focusing on kind, not in cash. And at the same time, if the girl is educated, I mean, to some extent, at least to the secondary level. So here, rate of dowry is a bit lower because the girl will work and earn and take part in the household economy. So if your girl is not that educated, you have to give more dowry. And if your girl is more educated, then she have to, the people will take less dowry, but they have to take part in the household economy. So there is a tendency even before the climate change impacts, the frequency, increased frequency of climate change impacts, the Sundarbans peoples, they make their girls learn more because they will get a good groom in a kind of city part. So the city, the mega city Kolkata, is quite near to the Sundarban. It's just 150 kilometer. So there is an impact of so-called city life. There is an aspiration of city life. So if I am educated, if I cross my secondary education, if I pass my college, I would get a groom from a nearby town. So, and that aspiration, and definitely the town groom will take less dowry because I will anyways earn and contribute to the household. So dowry has changed its face, but it's still there.
Correct, yeah. And you know, one thing that you are very clearly highlighting is the links between like labor and livelihoods and, you know, the impact that it has on intimate everyday relationships as well. And one of the things that I wanted to now focus a bit on were the stakeholders involved, you know, in the sense that when we're talking about these arrangements or, you know, when we're talking about even labor arrangements or marriage arrangements or say trafficking as well, who are some of the key stakeholders involved in that sense? You know, like, I mean, how do these things get fixed? And, you know, who are the people who are the decision makers on the ground?
Okay, so the first, I would say that, you know, for trafficking, there are hidden players that can come in any phase. Like it can be your relative, it can be your, especially the distant relative, it can be your own family member who is influencing the marriage or the trafficking. And even if not, it is not trafficking, even for the marriage, the community itself is taking initiatives to get the girl married off. So basically the neighbors, it can be neighbors, it can be your dad's friends, or it can be your relative. It can be anybody. At the same time, there are some players who are against this practice. They are also playing a crucial role. So first, definitely the government, because they have a child anti-trafficking cell who are actually enforcing the laws. The school teachers, they are also playing a very crucial role. And there are some NGOs who are the anti-trafficking NGOs. They are working really hard to, you know, stop these practices. But at the same time, I would say the most important player definitely are the stakeholders, as you say, are the parents. So if, I mean, even if many a cases, you find that, you know, the, I mean, this is not particularly in Sundarbans, it is common everywhere. If the NGOs come, if the government police come, the parents, they say that my girl is above 18. And there are, you know, many, the parents even, they do, you know, they make false birth certificate or false PDS card for to prove the girl is above 18. So parents are the most crucial stakeholder. So if, because maybe they are in dire stress of economic stress, or sometimes they feel like, you know, if we get her marry off, so she can have a better life in some other place, which is not as vulnerable as Sundarbans. There won't be any, you know, cyclones or floods. So sometimes that is also in parents' mind. And I mean, nobody to blame, but the situation is very phobic and complex.
No, absolutely. And I think that is one of the reasons, right? Like when we talk about this whole element of, you know, one, two things that you point out was just the idea around age itself, where there are practical sort of challenges of defining age. And our laws in some way are defined around that, right? What are some of the challenges that you face with that? Can you speak a little bit more on, like you spoke about, like documentation? You know, what are some of the ways in which that you think that these stakeholders are part of the problem as well?
See, I have a couple of, you know, anecdotes and some NGOs. I talked to the NGOs who work against the trafficking. I recently met an NGO which is working on trafficking since last 10 years. They rescued, I think, in last 10 years, they rescued at least 19 to 20 girls. All were trafficked. But the major narrative of the NGOs working there or the government is like the parents needs to understand. Though I haven't talked any parents because that is a very hush-hush affair. So nobody will agree that their girl was 18. Even we conducted some FGDs, we conducted some in-depth interviews, but nobody was, you know, because they know they have done something against the law. They're fully aware of that. It's not like, you know, that they are saying that yes, we did that. So what? We think it is right. We did that. No, everybody knows that they have done something wrong. Every parent. So that's why they don't want to open up. And but the NGOs are very vocal. Even they were like, yes, this family has done an underage marriage. But the argument the parents are giving that no, our girl was above 18. We haven't done anything wrong. And you know, the age, especially the girls who aged are like 16, 17, it's very hard to, by looking at their physique, the bar between 16 and 18 is very, the line between 16 and 18 is very blurred. You cannot just by seeing them, if the girl is healthy, you cannot say. So here the advantages they are playing, especially the parents. But and another problematic thing is that, by the next year, even if it is not trafficking, it is a simple marriage. By next year, the girl will be pregnant. So the entire, if you see the entire life course of a girl, so she became malnourished the food is scarce in the house. So with all the micronutrient deficiencies, like, anemia is very prevalent there. So the girl is growing up, and as soon as she, reached the age of 15, she got married. By the age of 16 or 17, she would have a child, which is again a low birth weight baby because the mother is undernourished. And that baby also carries out this same cycle. So the entire life course, it's a cumulative disadvantages. In terms of health, if we see, it is a cumulative disadvantages. But that perception, that understanding, I can't say that there is, the people are not ever fully aware about that. But it is a distress choice. They know what is right and what is wrong, what is good for their girl and what is not good. But it is, they are in stress. They are in their existence is at the stake. So they hardly have any choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this whole intergenerational passage of these vulnerabilities or these conditions is something which you bring about, I think, is very, very crucial. I just have like two more questions in the conversation. One of the things I wanted to ask you was on the impacts of the pandemic, which continues to rage on. What have, already the region is vulnerable, going through a lot of things. And what has COVID done now? How have these things, what is happening on the ground essentially?
Okay, so yeah, this I should have mentioned it earlier also. The COVID situation, like in other parts of country, we count the gravity of the COVID situation in terms of death or, morbidity. But here the problem was in Sundarbans, the problem was most of the people who were out migrated, they came back. They stayed in the temporary medical camps. And they were at home. So that's not a problem. In terms of COVID disease, Sundarbans didn't have much impact. So it is most of the areas are very remote areas. So and at some point of time, government, closed the gateways to get into Sundarbans. And in a way, they did right because the health infrastructures are very poor in Sundarbans. So it may not be possible to handle if there was a huge burden of disease. So by terms of disease, there was no problem. But the remittance they were earning, the people were earning the remittance, that was a huge loss. And, according to the anecdotes of some NGOs working there, so that this marriages and, trafficking has increased during the COVID. Because people they don't have any other options. And even during the strict lockdown, they had marriages. Though I cannot say these are scientific data, it's just anecdotes from the field. And so the NGOs I worked closely with, they said that that marriages has increased. So some NGOs I know, they started counseling centers. They had to start counseling center because school was closed. Another crucial point was schools were closed. So the limited amount of counseling the parents or the girls are getting, that was also stopped. So the NGO, they had to start counseling center, counseling camps, just to make the parents understand in one of the very vulnerable island called Moshuni. So they had to start counseling camps just to make them understand that don't drop out from school and don't get married and just wait for the pandemic to over and start your life fresh. So that things happens.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that the pandemic also did, like you also pointed out, was sort of bring to the fore already existing sort of vulnerabilities, right? Like, I mean, increase it manifold. And that sort of takes me to the final question, you know, which was on what are some community driven solutions or what is a way forward in some way, you know, because you spoke about like state intervention, you spoke about the ways in which, you know, families sort of negotiate with the law and other things. But what are some community driven solutions that you've been seeing on the ground and you think which need to be worked on in the near future?
Okay, so this question is very crucial to answer because many people ask me this question. So, but honestly say, I don't have any answer because there is no straight line. If you say the community-led interventions or community-led initiatives, is there any initiative which is community-led? I don't think so. All the interventions, all the initiatives, though very well-meaning in Sundarbans or in other vulnerable areas also, those are community-based. But very few of them are community-led. So community of Sundarbans, they are very busy just for the secure their survival. They don't have anything in their mind. So it is a high time to test their resilience. We just need to stop to test their resilience. And we need to think a long-term planning. It can be, you know, as mentioned by many scientists, a planned evacuation or another alternative skill building or maybe some ecological restorations. We have to, you know, identify the loss and damage adaptation policies. We have to check what about the loss and damage of adaptation policies there, which will work or which will not. And we need to think of long-term, beyond that, you know, short-term disaster risk reductions. We have done enough about the disaster risk reduction. The region like Sundarbans, they definitely require the disaster risk reduction plan, but they need beyond that also. So unless the policymakers, the policy interventions are towards that, it is very difficult to, I mean, get into the root of the problem. People are very busy. People are simply busy to secure their survival. They have done enough. So, I mean, personally, I feel like, you know, there is no community. Community has done enough. So they need resources. They need support. Do whatever you have to do, but do something. I mean, we cannot just left them like this. I'm not an expert to, you know, say that this is the way out. This is a very complex situation, and no single way out is, you know, perfect. So if we talk about climate change transformations, we need many transformations. We need many adaptations, not a single line. So if we think adaptations are transformation in silos, we would be fail again. So you have to think multiple pathways of reducing their vulnerability and make at least their future secure. You know, when I started working in 2011 in Sundarbans, the people were not ready to leave the land. They said that it is the motherland. So, you know, the so-called motherland sentiments were there. But in last 10 years, they are so phobic. They want to just get out of this island, at least for their children. They are trying their best to, you know, make their children out of this island. They don't want their children to be there. So that's their future aspiration. And they know that their generation is finished. They can't do anything. whatever they are, you know, gathering the assets for their children to stay out of Sundarbans. Even by marriage, even by education, even by whatever means, they just want their children to be out. So that is the situation. And I really don't know what is the solution.
Yeah, no, you make very compelling points there. And yeah, I think it is a very complex problem at hand, as you point out. Before we, you know, end the call, I just had one last question to just go back to something that you pointed out earlier. And I was wondering, with, you know, the location of Sundarbans being so crucial, right, in this whole conversation between like India and Bangladesh, just in terms of like the existing conversation around, you know, migration and refugee crisis and other things, what does climate vulnerability do to, you know, this existing socio-political situation at hand? And how does it sort of affect the women and girls in particular?
Okay, see, I mean, both the countries, Sundarbans, are facing the same problem. But the important point is that, you know, we know that there are migration, there are influx from Bangladesh part, from Indian part. I mean, it's both way. It's not the single way, it's both way. And both the government knows that. We all know that. But the thing is that there were some treaties also between two governments regarding the migration, regarding other political issues, especially the water issues. So, but the major thing, I guess, like, there is no platform between the countries to, you know, learn from each other experiences. Like, if I say that, you know, Bangladesh has done quite a lot of thing on the climate adaptation, especially in the vulnerable region like Sundarbans. So India needs to learn that. And some other things India has done, Bangladesh needs to learn that. So unless we are, you know, we are in a position to create a platform to learn by the countries, and maybe from the failure, we need to learn from the failure. Like, something is some intervention which has already been, you know, failed in climate change intervention or climate sensitive interventions, which has been failed in Bangladesh. Indian part is repeating that now. I mean, there is no point repeating, because the ecology, because the people, the geography, the morphology, geomorphology are same. So which has been failed there, it is going to be failed here also. So that understanding needs to be built. And we may like to think, I mean, it is a future call, or I'm working towards that also. That think Sundarbans beyond its political boundary. Think Sundarbans as an unified region, and try to find the solutions, I mean, irrespective of whether it is a part of India or part of Bangladesh.
I think, again, thank you so much. I mean, I've learned a lot in the last hour that we've, you know, been conversing.
So my pleasure. Completely my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
The Climate Brides podcast is supported by the University of Cambridge Public Engagement Starter Fund 2021. If you want to learn more about today's topic, head over to our website, where we have full transcripts of the episode, a specially curated reading list, climate models, and infographics. Until then, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the Climate Brides page on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay tuned and stay updated.